This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. When we look at groups that have shaped this land that is now called Vermont, that have had the greatest impact on this piece of terra firma, we'd start with the Abenaki or Abenaki. French and British settlers would figure high on the list, and then we'd get to sheep. Wait, what, sheep? Consider that at one point in the 19th century, Vermont had six times as many sheep as it did people, and Addison County was considered internationally as the epicenter of the sheep industry. But you can drive around Vermont now for days without meeting a sheep. So what was it that drove Vermont to global ovine dominance and then to the point of irrelevance? Here to answer those questions is Rebecca Woods. She's an environmental historian at Columbia University and a native Vermonter. And Joe Emenheiser. Joe is a livestock specialist at the University of Vermont Extension. Rebecca, Joe, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
All right. Rebecca, let's start with you. I'm going to give you a chance on this too, Joe. But briefly, make the case that sheep really do belong on that short list of those who had a major impact on this land. Rebecca?
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think that the statistic you started with, that there were six sheep to every person in Vermont in the early 19th century is a really good one. I mean, I would add to that in spatial terms that the sheep per square mile in Vermont were 165 in 1835, as compared to New York, which was also high at 112. And then Addison County alone had 373 sheep per square mile. So this was a really, it's hard to imagine how dominant this industry was.
Wow. And, Joe, your
and
turn.
Of course,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. I was going to say each of those little sheep has four hooves. So when you talk about impact on the land, right?
That's incredible. Joe, your chance to make that shape for, sheep case.
Well, there's no doubt that the numbers of sheep were pretty astounding, 1.5, 1.6 million in the peak of the 1800s, and woolen mills on every river corner, and just that infrastructure that we can still see the remnants of today.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, how did it happen that Vermont even got into the sheep business?
So sheep are a really useful frontier animal. One early 20th century historian called them a frontier crop. They're more independent, for instance, than dairy cows, which were sort of there all along, but became ascendant in the latter half of the 19th century in Vermont. And so that makes them useful it made them useful to Europeans in early phases of colonization, not just in northern New England, but elsewhere throughout the world. Spanish, French, English colonists all relied on sheep as a way to kind of start to make use out of so-called New World lands. The first phase in Vermont was a kind of haphazard situation where there were just a lot of mongrel-type sheep involved. And then when the kind of peak numbers we're talking about in the 1840s, this 1.6, 1.7 million sheep, that came out of a couple of things, one of which was an effort stemming from the late 18th century to combat British competition on the market for manufactured goods. So these animals produced wool that was fed into the mills in order to produce goods for domestic consumption that would wean the relatively young country off of imported British equivalents.
Mm-hmm. How did they get to Vermont, though? How did Vermont step into the fray?
Mm-hmm. So one way to ask that question would be to be kind of like, well, why not New Hampshire? Why not Connecticut? I think some of it has to do with the topography of Vermont and the climate of Vermont. You know, the state has sort of gentler mountains than New Hampshire, for example. So you can graze them to higher elevations. It also had the kinds of cataracts you need in the south of the state to set up mills. So Vermont had like 33 mills, I think, in the early 19th century. And so there's kind of the proximity of the pasture to the place of transformation, which was helpful. It also had, you know, it was also part of, it wasn't distinctive, or I mean, it was distinctive in the kind of scale, I think, of the industry, but it wasn't distinctive in having sheep alone at this time. Mm. This was a period when everybody wanted sheep, and everybody in particular wanted Merino sheep because they produced the finest wool. And with the Napoleonic invasion of Spain in 1809, it suddenly became possible for other places to have Merino sheep. So in addition now to the earlier kind of sheep I talked about that were just a sort of anything goes breed, by 1810, northern New England, Vermont in particular, has now a lot of Merino sheep, or starting to have a lot of Merino sheep to to feed wool into these mills.
Listeners, do you raise sheep for wool, for meat, just because they're fun to have around? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Joe, Rebecca mentioned Merino wool. So what was the big deal about Merino wool? You know, why did that launch Vermont into the international sheep spotlight?
Well, there's a lot of factors at work, and it's, I mean, again, just to reiterate, it's pretty astounding to think about a point when world domination, for example, is established on wool markets, when wool was used for so much more clothing and not, you know, there wasn't access to the synthetics that we have today. And the Spanish Merino sheep was kind of the pinnacle of this fine wool production, which is ideal for garments. The finer diameter fibers, you know, have less itch factor and so forth. So what positioned Vermont for that, I think, was the geographic advantages that were mentioned. But then there's also some interesting things there that, in terms of the amount of rainfall that we get, that the Merino sheep really is not necessarily a logical fit for Vermont. You know, it's a white-hoofed, soft-footed sheep that's, you know, susceptible to foot rot and those sorts of things in mud. The wool is so dense that it can be susceptible to wool rot or other fiber damage as a result. And so it was really just an advantage that worked at the time. And then as we expanded westward into more arid, open states,
right,
the Merino fit better there.
And so did we have problems with that, with the Merino sheep here?
Absolutely.
No kidding.
And there were problems associated with those things when Vermont Merinos went to Australia, for example.
Mm-hmm. So, Rebecca, you did a little bit of this, but give us a picture of what Vermont looked like at the pinnacle of this sheep craze. You know, the years we're talking about, how many sheep, how many farms were involved, their sizes, that kind of thing.
So the pinnacle was really 1840. I mean, that's the peak, and then after that it rises until 1840, and then it starts to drop quite precipitously. So by 1870, the sheep population in Vermont had dropped by 64%. At the peak, what you would have seen would have been a lot of sheep on a lot of relatively small farm sizes by comparison to the American West, which was just mentioned, or Australia. By Vermont standards, the farms were quite large. People talk about the records. A lot of people remembered, you know, moving north, for instance, to the kind of frontier of the state, as wealthy neighbors who were getting rich on sheep breeding were buying up neighboring farms for pasture. So you're getting these kind of large-ish, by Vermont standards, farms. The Connecticut River Valley and Addison County, the Champlain River Valley, these were the primary sites of sheep breeding. So you would have seen, and this is where you would have seen a lot of the Merinos. In other parts, on sort of more marginal ground, and particularly in situations where, because what the other guest was saying about the characteristics of the Merino that make the damp climate in Vermont problematic, that meant that they required quite a lot of care And a lot of oversight to be kept healthy. And so in slightly more extensive circumstances, you would have seen the remnants of the so-called native stock of sheep, those mongrel mm-hmm. sheep.
Joe, from a farmer's standpoint, let's look at it that way. What did it take to operate a sheep farm in that era?
Sheep and a willingness to do it, I guess.
Rebecca just mentioned it. They did take more care of these merinos than sheep normally would. But, I mean, on a sheep farm, especially with – you just let them graze. When I go to Scotland, I see them just out in the open, sometimes in the middle of the road. Is that the way it was in Vermont? You just kind of had a shepherd? How did you bring them in? Something like that.
Well, there was fence and those sorts of things as well. It wasn't quite the open range models that we're talking about. But I guess the overarching thing I would say here is that the market opportunities were so strong at that point that there were so many different ways that sheep could be raised to work, and to some extent that's true today too, but as was mentioned, the nature of the operation was hefted to the land and hefted to the markets, proximity to mills and so forth. But there was even in the fragmented parts of the state, there was a cooperative structure where everyone's producing a similar product. And so every part of the business from genetics to marketing was collective, mm-hmm. and allowed people to pool those fragmented flocks together and achieve an industry.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Oh, I was going to say that's something that was really remarkable to Australian visitors, for instance, in the 1870s and 1880s, because that element of cooperation among these sort of smaller farmers and breeders, they were. Visitors were struck that, you know, if they went to one farm and asked for a certain kind of characteristic, they would say, oh, you know, try our neighbors.
Oh,
they saw that as a very remarkable degree of – they called it kind of like brotherly, you know, spirit. And the other thing, too, that they remarked on – and this, again, goes to the kind of style of farming in Vermont – was the degree of care bestowed on these animals. They said they to them, they looked like they were being treated like racehorses because they were being, you know, carefully – tended, brought in at night, covered when they needed covering from the snow, et cetera, which was very, very different than how merino farming went on in Australia, for example.
So what about auxiliary industries? We mentioned some of the textile mills that existed. What other kind of industries would have been spun off because there was this massive sheep industry in Vermont at the time, Joe?
Well, at that time, wool was key.
Yeah.
But sheep historically have always been referred to as animals of the golden hoof because they have the ability to produce so many different products on minimal inputs. So there certainly was some lamb as a byproduct of all of that wool production. Not to say that there weren't a large number of merino wethers, which is a castrated male, that were used for wool and not for breeding because it was profitable at that time. But there were meat markets. As a result of the need to clear all the land for sheep, there's a timber industry that comes from that. And the whole ecosystem, both economically and naturally, is impacted by these sheep. I was just in a conversation this morning about the effect of all the land clearing and then the consequent regrowth of woodland on the bobolink population.
Mm.
So none of this happens in a vacuum.
Right. Rebecca, would I be wrong to say that the sheep industry was the biggest industry in Vermont at the time, or was there something else that eclipsed it and this was just part of Vermont's industry or Vermont's economy?
I think you're right to say that. I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that, you know, that until the latter half of the 19th century, until like kind of after there was a second boom for Vermont in the 1870s and 1880s with breeding stock, So until after that, it was a greater industry than dairy. I'm pretty sure as well. I mean, you know, Vermont had a really strong agricultural character, as it still does, and again, one that was based around livestock agriculture more so than wheat crops or anything like that. So I think, I mean, it was certainly the strongest part of the animal agricultural sector.
Mm-hmm. I will give a little tourist tip. If you want to see one of the textile mills or the remnants of it from that era, Green Bank Village, which is part of Danville, is a great stop. You can still see actually the footprints of the mills that were there. I think they had as many as 50 people who were working in the mill in a little village called Green Bank Village, just south of Danville. Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say that in terms of industries, until we had refrigerated transportation options, mm-hmm. that really limited the ability of the dairy industry to grow beyond sustenance. And wool is something that can be shorn and stored for years and transported. So that opened up more industrial opportunities at that time.
We're talking about the role sheep have played in the development of Vermont. I want to know what you think about Vermont, what it looked like back then. Do you have a taste for lamb or mutton? You can share your thoughts by calling 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We have heard from Savage Heart Farms, and they posted that we moved here from Chicago 3 years ago so that I could follow my dream of having a sheep farm. 18 lambs last spring, raising them for fiber, a marvelous adventure. Just ahead, we're going to look at the impact all those sheep had on the landscape in Vermont in the 19th century. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. I'm Rick Zingari. This is Vermont Edition. At its peak, New Zealand had more than 20 sheep for every person living there. It earned the nickname of the Land of the Long White Cloud because the country's islands, populated by the fluffy tufts of wool, looked as if they were socked in by clouds. Well, Vermont in the 1800s wasn't a whole lot different. There were nearly 2 million sheep running about, and a lot of our forests had been cleared away. Today, we're looking at the reasons Vermont became a sheep state and how that ended. I'm speaking with Rebecca Woods, an environmental historian at Columbia University, and Joe Ebenheiser, a livestock specialist at UVM Extension. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us your thoughts or questions. You can send them to vermontedition@vpr.net. So now let's look at the impacts of having almost 2 million sheep trotting around Vermont. Rebecca, how did it impact the landscape?
Well, it would have looked much, much different. Joe mentioned the timber industry that came out of clearing the land for sheep, and that would certainly have changed the appearance of the landscape. You would have seen a lot of bald hills as opposed to forested ones, the ones we kind of take for granted today as being a natural part of the landscape. In the middle of the 19th century, there was almost 70% of the land under farm, and even more in 1880 when it peaked. So it would have been it would have appeared to be a much more intensively used agricultural landscape, certainly.
Joe, this deforestation, was it caused by settlers looking for building supplies and firewood, or was it to clear that room for sheep, or both?
I would say the two played off of each other. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the existing markets for sheep, I think, were the impetus.
And why do they need so much land? Why do we have to get rid of forests to have sheep?
Well, I mean, it's a simple matter of sunlight reaching the forest floor and allowing grass to photosynthesize and grow.
The sheep would much prefer grass than gnawing on trees.
They do a little better that way, yeah.
All right.
Unlike
goats, that's right. We have Brian calling in from Jericho. Brian, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I've read some, I'm wondering if Vermont's similar to Massachusetts, from what I've read, that the sheep industries, charcoal industries, timber industries are kind of glamorized, but that they were unsustainable anyway due to this erosion on the steep hillsides. Wondering what the guests think about that.
Rebecca, can you handle that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that we tend to think about agriculture is that some forms are sustainable and others aren't. And that's kind of true. I mean, like the dairy industry requires a lot of extra input as well. So it's, you know, it's important to remember that almost any form of agriculture requires inputs back into the land to prevent kind of soil depletion and so forth. And sheep farming is no different. Hillside erosion would be much worse under sheep simply because they can walk higher usually than cattle. They're a little bit more mobile, so they'll trod higher, and so you would see definitely their traces higher up.
Mm-hmm. And Joe,
and that would include erosion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Joe, what do you say about Brian's question?
Well, I think that at the time, what was said was true, that the practices were not sustainable, but we have changed in our knowledge, of grazing systems and so forth since that time, become more environmentally aware. And I think it's just important to point out that it's not necessarily a sin of sheep, but perhaps the way that we're managing them. So there are ways to intensively graze sheep on hillsides for short durations of time, which allows soil and sod building and provides that protective layer that can help prevent erosion even above forested land. So there are some options. There are things that we can do to use sheep to better the environment. I'm not saying that those were done in 1840.
That's what I was going to ask you next, if the farmers in the 1800s would have been privy to that kind of knowledge.
No, I think they were privy to the financial incentives of producing as much wool as they could.
And another thing too, sorry, and just one other thing about the attitude in the 1840s, and this is a period when even Vermont still had something like a frontier towards the north of the state. So there was kind of the sense that even if you're overgrazing in one place, like you could probably move on to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rebecca, here we are in the 1800s, 1840, Addison County, like we said, the epicenter of the sheep industry globally. So what was going on in New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Quebec? Did they get that ovine fever?
New York and New Hampshire, to a certain extent. I'm not sure about Quebec. I think that just picturing the drive north to Montreal, right, it flattens out quite a lot when you cross the border. So I think probably pockets. But Vermont was really the kind of like most had the strongest mania for sheep. So for instance, while Vermont had 1.7 million sheep in 1840, New Hampshire had only 600,000, and Maine as well had a lot of sheep, but they tended to be less oriented towards the merino industry. But Joe is right. Everyone was trying to cash in on the economic opportunities that wool afforded in northern New England in particular. And then later, once American settlement expanded into the more arid West, Vermont was particularly good, and this made Vermont stand out from its neighbors, particularly good at producing breeding stock for those westward sheep industries.
Well, let's talk about that. We were the king. We're the king of merino wool. We're the epicenter of the sheep industry. And then where did it all go? Joe, you first.
Well, I mean, we're talking about 1.6 million sheep, just for perspective, at the moment in Vermont, based on the 2012 census, which is the most recent, we're at about 19,000 sheep and lambs. Those are spread over about 800 farms here in Vermont. That's growing, which is maybe a little bit unlike other parts of the country. We are growing at a faster rate than many states, but we're still certainly small compared to that point. The other shift is, the larger commodity markets have shifted more from wool to meat, and that's just a matter of the value of those products on an industrial scale. There are some smaller hand spinner flocks that can get the accelerated dollars that they need to cover the operating costs of a ewe for the year from wool exclusively, but it's more likely that there will be meat as some part of that.
Mm-hmm. But Rebecca, 1840, we're the king. How quickly did we lose them? Where'd they go? I mean, how did it happen in the 1800s that all of a sudden we're no longer that concerned about sheep?
Yeah. It's a confluence, really, of different competitive forces. I think that, you know, one of the primary ones is competition from other wool-growing regions. That included the American West, and it included Australia. Because at the same, you know, so Vermont peaks with the number of sheep in 1840, that's just when Australia is starting, the exponential growth of Merino sheep in Australia is beginning. One of the earliest exportations of wool to Britain from Australia is 1830. So they're just getting off the ground. That has a major impact. Another big impact is cotton. Joe mentioned earlier synthetic fibers that compete with wool today, but in the 19th century, cotton was the primary alternative to wool, and the cotton industry globally was dominated by the U.S. South, and then, so after the Civil War, cotton rebounded, and merino and wool, particularly merino wool, crashed again. So for instance, from like a high in terms of sheep prices from several thousand dollars from breeding rams, conditions in the 1870s when you could have just a sort of non-fancy ram would have cost $300 to $500. After that, sheep start to be sold. These same animals sold for $1.50 a piece, 75 cents, $1.50, and they're just being sold for slaughter. And then the other big change, as Joe pointed out, you know, the dual purpose and, well, actually multi-purpose nature of sheep with refrigeration, with refrigerated shipping, which becomes more and more prevalent by the 1860s, 1870s, the meat market shifts as well. And so people begin to breed not just merino sheep for wool and the kind of non-improved native mongrel herds, but they start to keep English mutton breeds as well. So the proportion of merino sheep in Vermont in 1840 was like 70, almost 70% of the sheep, and it falls to less than 30 by 1880 or 1890, and the proportion of fancy English mutton breeds rises to 60, and that's to supply the Boston market primarily.
Gotcha.
And again, just to reiterate, there's some market pressure, certainly the change in the meat markets, but a lot of it boiled down to cost of production. And as the American West opened up, it was far cheaper to overwinter a ewe in those environments. And then fundamentally, like I mentioned before, the merino sheep, being a fine wool, white hoofed breed, is just better suited to those arid environments. Now, we didn't use full merinos in the American West. They were used as composites, and many of the Rambouillet and other white-faced wool breeds that we use now are only part merino. And there's some environmental reasons for that too, but that's where they went and, mm-hmm. and why.
Listeners, we're talking about sheep in Vermont, the role they played here. Let's talk to Roy. He's calling in from Wilder. Roy, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's up?
Hi. I'm on the interpretive staff over at the Billings Farm and Museum, and the role sheep played in Vermont agriculture is a big part of our historical interpretation to the public. I just wanted to point out that William Jarvis was very instrumental in the introduction of sheep in Vermont. He was consulate to Portugal in the early 1800s and imported a herd himself and convinced his neighbors that raising sheep was a good thing to do. And that's where Merino Madness actually started, was in Wethersfield.
That's right.
And one other note is that all the stone walls you find in Vermont in the most unlikely places are probably the result of sheep farming. So those are my two comments. It's a great show. Very interesting. Thanks. That's
excellent comments. Yeah. It was old William Jarvis who got the Merinos into Vermont all those years ago and started the craze, which is really was at its peak, 1.6 million sheep in Vermont, and Addison County being the epicenter of the sheep industry at that time. So, Joe, you know, we heard Rebecca kind of give us that precipitous drop-off from the sheep industry. What happened after that? You know, was there already a rise in the dairy industry, or was there a gap between, you know, the sheep industry bottoming out and then dairy rose? What happened kind of in that gap?
I don't fully know the answer to that. Maybe Rebecca has more historical perspective.
Rebecca?
They sort of shift in tandem, you could say. I think that you know, on an individual level, people would have experienced a gap, right? So people who were making their fortune sheep breeding, if they had all of their sheep in one basket, so to speak, you know, they would have felt the pinch that came from the drop in the market. But by the 1890s or so, butter is becoming is a big part of Vermont's industry, and that's again butter. It's like solid milk products. First mm-hmm. cheese, and then butter takes it over for the Boston market again. And so that already sort of in the overall picture had begun to mitigate the loss of income from sheep farming. And then by 1900, as Joe said earlier, with the kind of advances to refrigeration, milk becomes a major export from Vermont, again, to regional urban centers.
So, Joe, go ahead.
No, that's all I was going to say.
Okay. So, Joe, what does sheep farming look like now? Who raises them? What scale? Meat, wool? What's going on?
Well, the census numbers, again, say that we have about 10,000 breeding ewes, 19,000 sheep and lambs. 80% of those sheep, which accounts for 99% of the farms, are on flocks of less than 100. And actually, 86% of those farms have fewer than 25 ewes. So we're very small. We're very fragmented. We have a diversity of breeds. And we produce such a variety of products from all these different operations as opposed to an industry. You know, the Vermont Sheep and Goat Association, which is the organization that represents many of these producers, you know, I advised on their board, and one of the biggest challenges they have is how do we encapsulate all these different ways of raising sheep under one umbrella, because it is so fragmented and diverse.
We do have this question from Diana in Dummerston, Joe. She asked, is there a carrying capacity number of sheep in Vermont, kind of like there is for bears or deer? Is there room for sheep flock expansion without affecting the balance of forests, wildlife, and grazing livestock?
And I think there absolutely is. And one of the things that I do largely in my position is work with farmers that have aging dairy infrastructure. That's, you know, old hillside dairies, not suitable for modern dairy, but perfect for sheep. There's nothing happening on those farms at this time except for overgrowth, and the sheep can help make use of that land, improve the land, and produce product. So there's wide opportunities there.
And very briefly, Rebecca, any way that we'd ever see sheep come back, maybe not in the numbers before, but, you know, in large enough to make it an industry again of some import?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think people really – I think one of the things that accounts for the pattern Joe's describing, and also the listener's comment from earlier, is that people really like sheep farming. It's a really a really nice way to make a living, and it's a meaningful way for a lot of people to engage the land. But I think that with synthetics and with cheap cotton, it's unlikely that we'll see wool ever dominate the global textile market again.
Ah, sheep. They came, they frolicked, and eventually they mostly went away. Thanks so much for our guest today, Rebecca Woods. She's an environmental historian at Columbia University and a native Vermonter. And Joe Emenheiser. Joe is a livestock specialist at the University of Vermont Extension. Rebecca and Joe, thanks for being part of this discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up, Vermont has taken great pains to preserve its hills, dales, and waterways, and land trusts have played a big role in that. We'll find out how. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri for Jane Lindholm. We just heard about how Vermont's dedication to raising sheep in the 1800s caused massive deforestation in the state. The eventual switch away from raising sheep has helped our forests to rebound and once again cover about three-fourths of the state. And there are many groups who battle to make sure Vermont's farm and forest landscape, as well as our waterways and shorelines, remain intact. Chief amongst them are land trusts, and they come in all shapes, sizes, and missions. Here to tell us more about land trusts throughout the state is Jamie Fidel. He's the Forest and Wildlife Program Director for the Vermont Natural Resources Council. Jamie, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Good to join you.
A land trust works with a property owner to conserve the land. So how's that done?
So the land trusts work with willing landowners. These are landowners that are interested in conserving their property. They may still have an interest in doing some development on the property, and they'll work with the land trust to come up with an agreement about which lands could remain developed, which ones will become conserved, and they will thereby give up the development rights on those on the property. And they'll work with the land trust to define what kind of uses can be maintained on the property. So by and large, a lot of land trusts work with landowners to maintain both farms and forest lands, both productive forests, working forest, and wild forests. And so there's a lot of emphasis on maintaining the working lands, rural economy. And oftentimes recreational access will be allowed, and the landowner will just work with the land trust to define those uses which will be allowed on the property. Mm-hmm. And the landowner will hold, the land trust will hold typically what's called a conservation easement on the property, and that's the ownership of the development rights.
And to what benefit of the landowner?
So for the landowner, for one, there's a benefit of if they have a desire to conserve their property or to enter into a long-term plan about how their property will be managed, especially thinking about who will inherit the property and how it will potentially be maintained as farm or forest land. There's a benefit of working with the land trust just to know that you've conserved your property or thought about the future of the property and the future use. There can also be tax benefits. Working with a land trust and putting an easement on a property can reduce income and estate taxes. Sometimes it can reduce property taxes. So there's those additional tax benefits for landowners.
And quite often we think of, wow, this is the way, you know, we've saved these beautiful vistas, these farmlands, but it's not just farmland. So give us examples of other land that these trusts work to conserve.
Sure. So huge success story on the farm front. A lot of land trusts and land conservation organizations work with conserving forest, both productive working forest and wild forests. A lot of the land trust and specific land conservation organizations focus on shorelands and protecting important areas for riparian areas, areas that have significant ecological roles or services that they provide, recreation, a lot of successful projects throughout Vermont in conserving important areas for recreation, hiking, boating access, mountain biking, backcountry skiing, the list goes on and on. So it's a really diverse suite of resource values that have been maintained in Vermont through the work of the land trusts.
Jamie, why does it take a land trust to accomplish this? Can't we just expect the property owner to say, hey, this is a good idea, and they just do it themselves?
Well, the land trust have really come in to bring some organization, to bring some resources into structuring both how they can work with landowners to provide these benefits. For landowners in Vermont that, let's say, do not work with a land trust, many of them struggle with the burden of property taxes, and it's really hard with the rising value of land in Vermont to hold on to that for a long time, especially if you're interested in maintaining it for productive farmland or forest land and kind of for working lands. And so they may enter into the current use program and receive a property tax reduction. But it's really the land trust that can bring additional tax benefits, that can help work with a landowner to develop a good stewardship and management plan for that property. Oftentimes, the land trust will try and leverage federal money that comes through programs like the Forest Legacy Program, which was actually came into creation through the great work of Senator Leahy, to bring federal dollars. So at times, the work with a landowner who may donate their easement and then get the tax benefits, which we discussed. But sometimes a land trust will actually be able to leverage dollars to pay a landowner for a really key parcel of land that would then potentially be then flipped over into state or municipal or federal ownership. And there's been great examples of, you know, areas of the Appalachian Trail, Long Trail, coming into a public ownership from work of the land trust, working forests that have used forest legacy funding to be maintained. Just a recent project in Marshfield, where the Marshfield Reservoir was conserved by the Vermont Land Trust and is now been flipped over to the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation.
But we have an affordable housing shortage in this state. And I want to know, don't the efforts of land trusts run counter to helping us solve that problem, which is a key problem here?
So sure, affordability is a key issue for Vermonters, and we have the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board that uses money from the real estate transfer tax, and they allocate money both to land trusts to do land conservation, but they also allocate money to housing organizations, organizations like Housing Vermont. And so there are separate organizations, some of which are nonprofit, that are really focused on developing affordable housing. So Housing Vermont's produced close to 5,000 affordable apartments and 150 developments in Vermont. So I'd like to think that both serve a really important mission. We have organizations that are focused on affordable housing, and then we have the land trusts that are focused on maintaining our economy, our working economy, and helping landowners who are interested in conserving their land have options to do that.
Jamie Fidel is the Forest and Wildlife Program Director from the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And thanks so much for explaining the role of land trusts in the state.
Sure. Thanks for having me today.
And finally today, we'll hear some of the comments that we've received about recent shows. Joining me is Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. Welcome, Mr. Gale Rosen.
Hey, Rick. So last Thursday, we cast our gaze across the lake to get an update on what's happening in Plattsburgh. Colin Reed posted this note. I am a legislator for Clinton County and also a regional economic developer. In my short decade in Plattsburgh, this region has gone from one despondent about the loss of an Air Force base to one that is leading the way nationally in transportation manufacturing. State-of-the-art rail cars, hybrid-powered buses, and subway systems are now manufactured here. These manufacturers have brought thousands of jobs and continue to expand. The airport simply adds to what is becoming an increasingly diversified economy.
Monday on our show, we focused on craft brewing and craft beverages in Vermont, and we've heard from a number of you. Kevin in East Dover wonders, it seems Vermont has become a mecca for IPAs, a style of beer that is far from delicate and totally masks the malt profile. Is there a future for lager beer or beer that requires a malt profile in Vermont? As a home brewer, I know it's easier to hide brewing mistakes with a healthy dose of hops.
Tom and Stowe seem to have something similar to say. He writes, Vermont certainly has a fantastic craft brewing culture, but I feel like many people limit themselves by focusing only on the IPA craze. I've seen people come into a craft beer store that stocks hundreds of fantastic beers and leave empty-handed because they couldn't find Heady Topper or Sip of Sunshine. I always encourage people to branch out and try the variety of styles Vermont has to offer. Stone Corral's Black Ale, the great sour ales that Hermit Thrush Brewery in Brattleboro are making, and Lost Nation's Goza are just a few that come to mind.
Well, at least one of our guests, 14th Star Brewing CEO Andrea Gagne, says she thinks, yes, we've probably reached peak hops.
Jeff in Heartland also commented on the show saying, I was surprised that you and your guests made no mention of Hill Farmstead Brewery up in the North Country. In every national international beer contest, Hill always has more than one of the highest rated beers, selections like Susan. Because of its fame and iconoclastic format, would have been nice to touch on.
Well, touching on it was your job, Jeff. Well done. We always love listener calls and emails that help round out our program and offer suggestions just like the one you made in that email.
Moving on, last week we interviewed Sylvain Valancourt, who's Laval, Quebec Superintendent of Public Works, about the city's use of white beet extract with road salt to combat icy roads this winter. Kerry posted in Facebook, I used to work with a German couple, and they always said that is all they used in Germany on the roads when they lived there. No salt, just beet pulp.
Not sure if they used white beets or red beets in Germany. I do know that when Montreal tried red beet extract in the past, it wasn't pretty. We love hearing your thoughts on any of our programs, so please keep them coming.
You can always post on our Facebook page or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net.
Sam, thanks for your assistance.
No problem, Rick.
So Vermont Edition takes a little holiday break until Monday. We come back with something a little different for us. We're going to do a best of week. Jane Lindholm and each of the show's producers have gone back through the past year to choose interviews and show segments that stood out for us in one way or another. That starts Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Liam Connors directed the program, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening. Be very safe over the holidays.